Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right, because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1, only from Rust-Oleum.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome to a brand new series of the Rahalastupper Book Club. And what a start we have for you. We have two fantastic authors in one. We've got Lucy Worsley here to talk about her brilliant book, Agatha Christie, A Very Elusive Woman. Hello, Lucy. How are you doing?
Hello. I'm so happy to be here. I love this podcast. I listen to this podcast. So I'm really thrilled to be on it.
Hooray. Well, you can come on anytime you like. I'm sure you'll write many more books. As I feel I've said before, you've written around about a dozen books already. So you write history books and biographies. You also write some for young adults.
That's right. Yes, I have a sideline doing historical novels for sort of 11 to 14 year olds as well. Yes, but biographies is my sort of heartland. That's where I like to be.
Yes. And of those books that you have written, do you have a favourite one? Do you have one that people should start with, or is that impossible to choose?
You can't ask her that. That's like asking somebody who's their favourite child. I've written about the history of crime as a genre. I've written about Queen Victoria. I've written about Jane Austen, and she's someone who means a lot to me, actually, and to a lot of people in the world, I suppose. I'm drawn to female subjects with something a bit tricky about them, I suppose. I'm keen on difficult women.
Okay.
I can't think why they appeal to me, but somehow they do.
Well, so why did we go for Agatha Christie for this one?
Well, having had such a great time looking at Jane Austen, I think I was tempted by another author who, it seems to me, that in serious literary inquiry has been moving from the periphery to the centre, if you like. Yeah. This is a journey that Jane Austen went on. Nobody took her very seriously for a really long time. And the same thing has kind of happened to Agatha Christie. 20 years ago, it's unlikely that had you been at university studying literature, you would have found her on the syllabus. And there's been a huge amount of snobbery attached to her work throughout the 20th century, you know, trashy airport reading. It's a way of sort of positioning yourself as a great writer to say that there's something sort of inexplicable about her success, because she's really not a very good writer at all. But people are taking her more seriously now. I felt it was time for a fresh look.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting thing about literature in general, and obviously the book touches on this, but you know, something being popular is seen as a sign of it and being not as good as Ulysses, which is, you know, unreadable, that I have on my shelf, that I keep on thinking, I'll read that one day, but I will never read Ulysses. But I haven't read much Agatha Christie either, but I think I might give it a punt after reading this.
I think an awful lot of this is due to her gender, because the thing that is often said in relation to Agatha Christie is that, in terms of sales, right, global sales throughout history, the rankings go the Bible, Shakespeare, Agatha Christie. So the only people who have outsold Agatha Christie are Shakespeare and God.
Yeah.
And yet she achieved that while being female. And I sort of feel that people have sort of glossed over that because they think there's something very sort of establishment and conservative and kind of mainstream about her. But to achieve that, I think, was really extraordinary in a world that was then made by men.
It is incredible. I guess part of that is due to, I mean, she's very, she turns over a lot of work. She's also the world's most successful female playwright, which I learned from your book as well. So
yes, often overlooked that fact. Yes.
So she's turning it. She's churning out a lot of stuff. I suppose that might be why. And writers write in different ways. And some writers are very prodigious and some writers take 10 years to write a book. But you know, it's not necessarily a lesser skill to be able to do it quickly, I guess.
She is prodigious, and there's a handful of her books that I think are up there amongst the great books of the 20th century. But a lot of them are not at that level. I'm not going to argue that she was a consistently good writer, but there are moments when she is defining the genre of crime fiction. That's the nature of her achievement, I think.
Well, and people are still reading those books, you know, 100 years later. So it is. Yes.
And consuming them in other ways through film and TV and that sort of thing. They've been endlessly adaptable. And that's definitely a way in which she lives in people's minds to this day. And what I really hope to be able to do, if I can, is to take people back to the words on the page that she produced in the first place. And then behind those words into this, what I think was rather an extraordinary maverick life.
Yeah, it is a very interesting life, and exactly that. You know, I'm a fan of hers through the films. I mean, you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s, the sort of Peter Ustinov films were where I came into it, and I was sort of enchanted and bedazzled by those and loved them because of the mystery element and trying to guess what had happened. But obviously, they are quite different than the books. The bit I found very interesting was. I mean, lots of stuff, but the bit that sticks with me, because I read this book a few months ago, was that when she was, you know, she very nearly didn't get published at all. So she was sending her books off to publishers and getting turned down. And she was, you know, always nearly becoming a mother and a housewife or a wife. And the writing nearly took a back seat. But she did get sort of picked up by this slightly scurrilous publisher called John Lane, who ripped her off. But what's interesting to me is if he hadn't agreed to publish her, as much as she had trouble with him and had to get out of the contract she made with him, if he hadn't published her, then she might very well never have been known at all because, you know, nobody else was publishing her.
Well, yes. And I think that happened because she was a bit ahead of her time. It was extraordinary that she'd written a book in the first place when you consider that when she was born in 1890. She was born into a wealthy family, big house, servants. But then there was no expectation at all that a girl like her would ever work. It was her destiny to get married and to have children. So work was kind of a dirty word for nice young ladies like that. But then the family lost all of its money and World War One came along. And because of that, she went out into the public sphere, if you like, and she became a nurse helping out. And she began to think, okay, maybe I would get satisfaction by doing some actual work and getting paid for it. So she went out to the marketplace with her book. And it was only after the war, right? She's really a writer of the 1920s. And it was when the war was over and some women had got the vote and some women had worked during the war and some women were doing extraordinary things like not get married, that the world began to be ready for a female writer. And when she took her book to the publisher, she said, okay, I'll choose a man's name, right? That's what women had to do. And the publisher was canny guy. And he said, no, it's actually the time for women to step forward. And I think that's because One way of looking at this is that the men had just basically massively messed up. There had been this four terrible, brutal years of fighting. It was time to let the other gender sort of have a go. And you can also see this was sort of brilliant and awful for Agatha Christie at the same time. You can see that the publishing industry in the 1920s, particularly newspapers and magazines, which is where a lot of her work first appeared, not between the covers of a novel, it was serialized. It was looking for female writers because the press at the time was wanting to shift its model from a newspaper being something that a man bought once a week to something that men and women bought every day. Right. So we're talking about new papers like The Sketch taking over the marketplace. And what these new papers wanted were articles by and about successful prominent women, which Agatha Christie was able to be rather fabulously at first, but then, and I'm sure we're going to come onto this, Richard, then it all went horribly wrong for
me. I'm sure, yeah. Yeah, but I think to any writer, I mean, obviously J.K. Rowling had a sort of similar thing where she sent Harry Potter off to lots of people and then it finally got picked up.
Yes.
There's this alternate reality where yes. Agatha Christie didn't get picked up by that publisher and then just went back to her life and we got none of this stuff, which is true.
There's a story about perseverance there. But also, she strikes me as somebody who kind of stands for the position of a lot of women who lived through her really long life as well.
Yeah.
She lived from 1890 to 1976. And other women as well were experiencing some of these changes that made their achievements possible.
Yeah, and I suppose that's what comes out from your book, is this sort of history of the change that came about in the 20th century. I mean, it's about class and it's about women and about the world changing through World War One and the 1920s, especially, I suppose. But yeah, she did keep going for a very, very long time. And we'll get on to 1926. Ooh, let's talk about that now, which is always the most talked about thing about her. And and I think you make a very good case for working out what might have actually happened in these days of disappearance that Agatha Christie experienced. But I don't want to give away too much of your book. But what are you prepared to say about this?
Oh, yes, 1926. This is the notorious year. And if people know anything about Agatha Christie's real life at all, this is likely to be the thing that they know about. And it what I think has coloured people's image of her as a woman who was a bit difficult. There's something a bit weird, there's something a bit tricky, something a bit incomprehensible about her. And what happened in 1926 is that she disappeared for 11 days and notoriously was discovered living in a hotel in Harrogate under a false name. And the story that was in all of these very gossipy 1920 newspapers at the time, and the story that has been repeated so often since, is that she did this for one of two reasons. Either to get publicity for her books, because she was a self-seeking, self-serving, over-committed professional working woman, or to frame her cheating husband. She did have this cheating husband.
Yeah.
With having murdered her. And these are very attractive stories, aren't they? And they're just what you would sort of hope would happen to somebody who wrote murder mysteries for a living. But yep. Neither of them are true. But those are the stories that the press ran with. I don't know if you'd like me to say what I think the real truth is.
Yeah, I mean, if you're happy to say, I mean, I think it's a very good, it seems correct, but let's go for it.
Okay, I'm very happy to say what I think the real truth is, because I want the world to know this. This is this is kind of what is at the core of motivating me to write this book, because I feel a sense of unfinished business about this. People often talk about the disappearance, as it's generally known, as a great mystery. And I don't think it's a mystery at all, because and it's also often said that after it, Agatha Christie never spoke again about the disappearance for the rest of her life. That's not true either. She did speak again. In 1928, she gave a very long, very detailed interview about what had happened, and she gave it to the Daily Mail. So it's really not a mystery, because she told millions of readers of the Daily Mail what had happened. But the thing is, they didn't want to listen to it. And I think they didn't want to listen to it because it's a story that was really hard to hear. It's still hard to hear. And the motivation for her giving this interview, I believe, is that in 1928, her divorce from the cheating husband was just about to come to court. And she'd had all of this bad press, you know, framing the husband, self-publicist. And what was at issue here was the custody of her daughter, her little daughter.
Yeah.
So what she was doing in this interview, I think, is speaking to the judge who was about to try this custody case. And she was saying, look, you've got to know what happened and you've got to understand that I'm not a bad mother. I did not go off and abandon my child without a thought. So she explained that on this December 19, 1926, she had been experiencing a desire to end her life. And she had taken a trip in her little car away from the family home. And she had driven it over a cliff into a chalk pit in Surrey, in the Surrey Hills. The context for this was the cheating husband, the death of her mother, kind of the pressure of success. She'd just written this really brilliant book called The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, and everybody was thinking, what's she going to do next? She was paying the mortgage on this big new house that they'd moved to. It all just got too much for her, and she began to experience mental suffering. And the next morning, when she had disappeared, her little car was found just poised over the edge of this cliff. And in it were things that were read as clues, like her driving license, her fur coat, some of her personal possessions. And you can see why this seemed like it was a publicity setup, because it seemed almost too good to be true. Where had she gone? She'd left these clues. Everybody started sort of treating it like a murder mystery story. But in this interview, she explains that she'd done all of this having left her daughter safely home in bed. Yeah. And she said she'd experienced urges to crash the car previous to this, but she had not followed up on them because her daughter had been with her. So the whole interview is about prioritizing the well-being of her daughter at a time of terrible suffering for herself.
Yeah.
And that's what breaks my heart, really, that she got, you know, maligned as a bad person because of all of this. And then I think psychiatrists would explain the disappearance and the mental state that she was in as a fugue state, which is a mental condition that's all about escape from an impossibly traumatic reality. So in a fugue state, you kind of, as I understand it, invent a new character in which you can bear to go on living.
Yes.
Which is what she did. And in this state, you can do normal things like take a train to Harrogate and check into a hotel, which is what she did. And she stayed in this hotel for 11 days, keeping at a safe distance from her child in Harrogate, a place at the time that was famous for medical treatment. And then she was found, she was spotted, she was famous, her name was in the papers. It all sort of played out. But fugue state, it was known about in the 1920s because a lot of people had experienced it as a result of war trauma. Yeah. Shell shock is kind of, shell shock is a popular and not very accurate name that sometimes gets sort of transferred onto this condition. But shell shock and fugue state as a result of war trauma, it was hotly debated and it was associated with shirking, right? A lot of people didn't believe that soldiers had had this condition, that they were cowards, that they were trying to get out of stuff. And some of that discourse sort of got attached to Agatha Christie too. It was it was like a swirling, awful melting pot of unfortunate popular culture currents that sort of caught her up. And she was just sort of thrown onto this heap of shame, if you like. She kind of got cancelled. And from that point onwards, she would never let anybody into her life. No more interviews. Very kind of protective, prickly, private personality, which is why, ultimately, when she died in 1976, people felt like they didn't really know her. They didn't really know who she was, that she was somehow difficult.
Yes. Yeah, well, it's interesting because the stigma both of a marriage breakdown and mental illness, which ran through the family anyway, and there was sort of suicide in her family as well, wasn't there? So there was that double stigma as well on top of that, and the police investigation sort of hampered by the fact that the husband wasn't willing to admit that he was having an affair because that would reflect badly on the woman he was having an affair with. So is this crazy? You know, you can just feel the kind of pressure of that even without being involved in it. The society's that sort of buttoned up that that people were having to lie even in the face of this weird experience of this woman going missing.
Yeah, and that was in 1926, but this stuff is still going on today. So yeah. At the time we're talking, Richard, we've just had in the UK the incident of Hugh Edwards, the BBC news reader, yeah. has been named in the scandal. And what did we hear? He's gone into hospital because he's suffering from mental health conditions. And I thought, Agatha Christie. And recently I read an interview with the actress Sharon Stone, who was in the film called Basic Instinct.
Yes.
And there's a particular scene in this film that I'm not going to describe what happens. Google it if you don't. No, in fact, don't Google it if you don't. But anyway, there's this notorious scene in that film where the actress, not the real person, the actress does something extremely transgressive and shocking. And I read an interview where Sharon Stone said, I believe that scene lost me custody of my daughter.
Wow.
When I got divorced. And I thought, Agatha Christie, she was just ahead of all of these people.
Yeah, it's definitely true, you know, and it's, you know, and the disbelief and people in all of these circumstances going, oh, well, that's, you know, they're putting that on, or the, you know, they're going to hospital to try and deflect from the truth. So yeah, you're absolutely right. It isn't much better now than it was then. And I, you know, I don't know how you change hearts and minds over stuff like that, but do you feel if she had, I mean, obviously there was points during that first day of this where she was at least half-heartedly trying to really kill herself or thinking about killing herself. If Agatha Christie had died in 1926, had she done enough by that point to, would she still be as highly regarded now? How do you think that would have affected her standing as an author if 1926 had been the end of Agatha Christie?
We would still be talking about her.
Yeah.
And we'd still be talking about her, Richard, I believe, because she had written The Murder of Roger Ackroyd.
Yeah.
That it had just come out that year. And this is, there are often polls for the greatest mystery novel ever. And that's usually the one that wins. She'd done enough to get immortality already. And that's even before she'd gone on to write other of her tip-top productions like and Then There Were None.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, you know, as you say, this, I mean, it starts with this nice, the book starts with this nice incident of her being on a train and find two women reading her books and talking about her and saying rubbish, saying that she's an alcoholic or that she loves drinking, which she doesn't. She likes drinking cream, which is sort of weirder. Again, that's a sort of early foreshadowing of fame. She was world famous and yet anonymous enough that she could sit on a train and hear people talking about her, which is interesting. But that incident, I think, is the book in a nutshell, as I'm sure you intended, because it's that example of fame versus the example of how you're perceived and this sort of unknowability about her, which I think we do get more of an idea of who she is than we might have done before. I mean, I was very, you know, I was surprised to find out you have an image of her as an old lady, really, don't you, I suppose? And so the idea that she'd surfed in Hawaii or done all of these different things is hard to ascertain. But you do go, you know, I think the book does open up that world of what it was like being a woman in the early 20th century. And a forward-thinking woman, yeah.
The greatest character ever created by Agatha Christie was Agatha Christie herself, because after the disappearance, after 1926, her public image was this very discreet, motherly, matronly, Miss Marple type old lady. So she, when people would say, what are your secrets of success as a writer? She'd say, I don't know. It just all sort of happened to me by accident. Because she felt, I believe, this need to downplay her professionalism, her genius. That is not what she felt able to reveal. And so a lot of people have this mental image of her, I believe, as somebody who looks a bit like Miss Marple, wearing a tweed suit, sitting in a garden, drinking tea, eating scones. And actually, this is an image that her American publishers really leaned into. They liked the idea that there was this mismatch between her her appearance and then what she was able to do, which is produce stories in which children kill, in which these extraordinarily dark things happen. But I think that was a sort of self-defense strategy. So one of the joys of writing about her has been the interrogation of the sources that is necessary to try to work out what's really going on here. Because, you know, she's trying to trick us all.
Yes. And I feel like, you know, as you sort of hinted at the beginning, there's a sort of connection between you and Agatha in that you're also an author and you're, and you also have a public image that you play up to, I think, which is a charming one and slightly coquettishly intellectual, but flirtatious, I suppose, image. Do you feel like, and also, you know, I don't know how much your career as an author was planned. It feels like you were going in other directions, and this career as an author has sort of happened to you. I don't know. Was that always your plan to go into writing books, or?
This is a very deep question.
It is, you know, but I just feel that there's that connection.
Yes, and you're similarly
defensive of the real Lucy Worsley.
I'm just thinking about that, yeah. It would be impertinent of me to suggest that I have anything in common with Agatha Christie. I mean, that would be so presumptuous and awful. That would be just ridiculous. And sometimes people say to me, what would you say to her if you met her? And I think, I wouldn't say anything to her. She would have found that just gross. She didn't want to chat to people like me, particularly not nosy biographers. But I guess that I can feel some sense of kinship in some of the strategies that she used to deflect attention away from the things that she was really trying to do. Because I suppose what I aim to do in my life is to wear learning lightly. If I have achieved anything, it's the goal of making people think about not only the past, but the present world in a slightly different way, but in a way that's fun rather than painful. I like to think of myself as the thin end of the wedge, if you like. I've got no dignity. I will do anything I can to sort of coax people over the threshold into the world of the intellect, into feeling like history, the past, holds something of interest to them. Because I am aware that a lot of people feel sort of alienated from it and don't think that it's going to hold any meaning for them today. So that's why in the past, yes, I have laughed about in silly costumes and things like that. And I've always wanted to write books. That's always been a long-held dream. Perhaps I came at it in a not entirely straightforward fashion, I suppose. My background has been working in museums and heritage sites and historic houses. Those were sort of my proper jobs that I have had and still have. I still work part time for historic royal palaces at Hampton Court Palace. So I know that when people come to visit Hampton Court Palace, they're not necessarily there to learn about the aesthetics of the Baroque or the politics of the Reformation. They might be there just to eat cake in the cafe with their granny. And, you know, I will take that with pleasure and I will work on it. Yeah. It'll sort of coax them in, if you like.
Well, so, I like that about this book. I feel is exactly that, in that it's very rigorously researched and academic, but equally, you know, you draw the reader in. I mean, I've seen a review that criticised for you this, but I think wrongly, saying, you know, you call Agatha's first husband hot and, you know, you do that sort of thing. But I think it actually draws the reader in, and it you know, like you say, no other academic has said.
He was hot. Have you seen pictures of him, Richard?
I have. I've looked
at the pictures. He was incredibly hot.
It was
all
right.
With that.
Yeah. But, you know, that draws people in to, you know, enjoy the book. So it's an enjoyable book. I listened to the audio book, which equally is always lovely to have you, the author, read. But there's a bit where you make an exasperated a grunt about the behaviour of men, I think.
My great dilemma was I going to do the Belgian accent for Poirot? And I decided not to.
Well, I think that may have been a good call.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
But yeah, I mean, I liked, there was a lot of the things I liked about the real Agatha Christie. I mean, I think the fact you talk about describing herself as a housewife in as rather than an author, but also the fact that she, I mean, do you think genuinely when the tax man came to call, she claimed that she hadn't thought of writing books as being an income, just thought it was a hobby, even though she was making a good deal of money out of it. Do you think that was genuine on her part?
Women and money. What are women and money? How does that the relationship play out? So interesting to me. And Agatha Christie, you'd think, became hugely wealthy as a result of being, we've established, the third best-selling author ever, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But her relationship to money was so complicated and kind of dysfunctional too. And I think that's all because she was born into wealth in 1890. You know, nobody taught her about money. She never had to think about money. She didn't go to school. She was home educated. Her only maths was her father would sit her down for half an hour after breakfast at the dining table and teach her a few sums, which is kind of a shame because she would have been really good at maths. And she said later on, I wish I'd been properly educated. And then the father was a total spendthrift and lost all of the money. And I just think that she was left with no conception of wealth, how to manage it, how to look after it. So she did get into all of this terrible tax mess later on, didn't keep proper records. And the pressure of this meant that she could never sort of relax and enjoy herself in later life. I think she was always worried that she was going to go bust again, like her father had done. And it appeared to her incomprehensible that she was able to owe all of this tax, which is, you know, it's her own fault. She hadn't kept proper records. She hadn't done the job properly. Yeah. And that's because she didn't think that she sort of had to, really.
And well, the family relationship is very interesting as well, because you say early on that she was like very loved as a child and very cosseted as a child and in this wealthy situation, you know, in this situation of wealth, the wealth was lost. But that her relationship with her own daughter seems a lot less close and less loving. And I mean, not that might not be the exact right word, but... She was obviously very committed to her career above her own child, it seems.
Yes. Isn't this interesting? One of the sort of points against Agatha Christie on the balance sheet is bad mother, cold, neglectful, bad mother, which partly comes from the fact that in 1926, she went off and she left her daughter behind. What kind of a mother could do that? I would argue a mother who had her daughter's best interests at heart, if she knew that she was in a state where she might hurt herself. But also another thing that she does in her books, right, is deal with mothers in the round. She absolutely does not subscribe to a sort of motherhood and apple pie version of mothering. She depicts all kinds of bad mothers, evil mothers, mothers who don't like their children. So that's another thing that has contributed to this air that she's somehow cold or neglectful as a mother. And it is true that she was a working mother, so she was often away researching books. She became a single mum for a while after the divorce. She was often away travelling the world researching books, leaving her daughter at boarding school. The flip side of that, though, is that she was a lot closer to Rosalind than many women of her class, because she was a single mother. You know, they did. Yeah. They were two against the world. And another thing that she did that perhaps verges towards actual bad mothering is to use her daughter as copy. And right. this is the sliver of ice in the heart of every writer, I think. Yeah. They very often, whether they admit it or not, use people around them yeah. as copy and put relationships down on the page that most people would prefer to keep quiet. So we do know that Rosalind would say to her, look, please don't put me in your books anymore. And I don't believe that Agatha Christie fully respected that. Or she was such a large, and I should say, she was such a huge, talented personality that I don't think she really gave her daughter the space in which to become her own person. Yeah. And her daughter made choices like to run off and very unexpectedly get married herself, perhaps as a way of trying to find a little bit of independence. I think being part of Agatha Christie's family in later life was a bit like perhaps being a member of, I don't know, the royal family or a presidential family. There was always a relationship between you and a human being, and also a relationship between you and some kind of an institution that must have been difficult for the people around her to handle.
Yes. And, you know, I think like anyway, when you delve into someone's life, as happens when biographies get written out, if they're renowned enough after their death, you're going to find some bad things as well as some good
you
things.
Are, you are.
And because that's the way we all are.
I'm endlessly dismayed by the concept of a bad mother, because there's no such thing, is it? No. There are just mothers. There are mothers who have good days and mothers who have bad days, and nobody's one or the other.
And being too close, you know, being overbearing is a parental down thing as well. So you know, it's all about where you draw your balance personally. Mm. And
this is actually one of the real challenges of writing a. This is a book club, so I feel it's okay to go under the bonnet.
Yeah, please do.
It's one of the challenges of writing a biography that you want people to enjoy because you kind of want people to root for the heroine of the story, and yet I just feel obliged to show them in the round, you know, everything, both good and bad about them. And I constantly sort of grapple with this, and I was told by somebody I admire, a sort of mentor biographer called Alison Light, and she said, you have to trust your readers to get that. You have to trust your readers to understand that it isn't straightforward, that human nature isn't a case of black or white, and that you're doing a disservice by trying to jazz up or beautify a person.
Yes. Well, I think, you know, I think you do a great job of making her likable and making her, I mean, you know, of being honest about her and making the reader interested. And like, again, one of the other downsides of Agatha Christie that you couldn't really sidestep is the anti-Semitism and racism that comes across in the books. But again, it is, it's sort of weird to judge someone by the standards of today, but equally, you know, must have been a hard thing to negotiate your way around.
Yes, that's very interesting, isn't it? People have such strong views about this. And I feel that often people sort of make category mistakes between fiction and history. And I hate the idea that people who maybe are coming to read Agatha Christie books for the first time today will be distressed or be put off by the fact that people in the 90s and 20s had attitudes that we no longer share. And I feel that it's kind of my duty to say that is what the world was like then. And we can still see the legacy of that in society today. So we need to know about it. We mustn't go, oh, tut, tut, and look away. We need to sort of explore it and lean into it and to discover why people thought those things. And that's why a reading of Agatha Christie as a historical source, if you like, because she was publishing from the 1920s right through to the 1970s. And you can chart during the course of that time the changing of social attitudes. There's a kind of a slow liberalisation of her attitudes. For example, by the 1950s, she was being quite positive about same-sex relationships and that sort of thing in a way that was really quite unusual in commercial fiction. And you get characters like Iraqi people sort of coming more fully rounded as the decades go on. You can chart a history of what mainstream, middle-class, moneyed readers of commercial fiction in Britain and America believe throughout the 20th century as well.
Yeah, no, so I mean, it is. I mean, I found that story interesting that, I think I've got this right, that she met a Nazi in the 1930s who was very extreme, you know, talking that Jewish people need to be destroyed and wiped out, and that upset her, but didn't entirely shift her away from
far from it.
Yeah.
I have to, if you go to read what's sometimes called golden age fiction more general, and this is the word for the fiction produced between the wars, the 20s and the 30s, Dolphy L. Sayers, A.O. Marshall, with these great writers, gonna find this anti-Semitism. So I think we should call it the golden age of fiction, apart from the classism and the racism and all of the anti-Semitism and the rest of it that sort of pervades it. But that doesn't mean don't read it at all. It means look and learn.
Yeah, and as you say, the stuff about domestic staff, which is, you know, is sort of inconceivable to a modern reader in a way, because you can't imagine anyone but a lord having servants. You know,
Yeah. One of the things that is sometimes sort of a cheap pot shot that people take at Agatha Christie is classist, doesn't take servants seriously. But that is. I think that's because people have seen the TV versions, where a lot of the sort of richness and the depth of the book is compressed into a sort of a much simpler way of looking at the world than she actually provides us with. She's really interested in servants. And I tell you what, she doesn't like toffs.
Right.
If there's anything she can be accused of, it's being anti-aristocratic. She's definitely a creature of the upper middle classes, if you like. And there are some moments where she explores the lives of servants, because the decline of domestic service, right, this huge institution, was something that she was very much affected by. It's something that she kind of personally experienced when she grew up. She had a cook by the 1950s. She was, well, after the World War, actually, she's doing the cooking herself. And after the 1950s, she was kind of trying to be the chatelaine of a country house while also doing a lot of the hands-on work of that herself.
Right.
In a way that would have appeared just, you know, insane to her mother.
And so someone like me who is, I don't think, because if I have read any Agatha Christie, it's a long time ago. If we were going to, because I didn't know she'd written under a pseudonym, so she's written like hundreds and hundreds of books. Where do I start? Where's the best place for me to start as a reader of Agatha Christie, would you say?
Well, I'm going to recommend The Murder at the Vicarage.
Okay.
Which is it was written in 1930, and it was a sort of a wedding present to her second husband. She did find love, which makes me happy for her. She settled down and had a happy life in the end. And this particular book was the first appearance in a novel of my favourite Agatha Christie character, who is Miss Marple.
Okay.
So it's set in a village. It's a sort of classic, what you think an Agatha Christie story is going to be like. And the way it works is that... to the people who were first reading it, they wouldn't have even known that Miss Marple was going to be the detective, right? She just appears as this slightly annoying little old lady who appears to have her nose in everybody else's business. And over the course of the novel, it slowly dawns on you that actually this negligible looking little old lady is the one with the biggest brain on the planet, and she's going to solve the case. It's brilliant the way that she sort of steps out of the garden into the centre of the action like that.
Oh, good,
and another
yeah.
sort of cute layer to the book is that Agatha Christie had just got married to an archaeologist. There's an archaeologist in the book, turns out to be a jewel thief.
That's good. All right, well, I'll start there. We'll have a look. And we ask everyone this. Are you reading anything at the moment, or have you read anything recently, not by you or Agatha Christie, that you would like to recommend to our listeners?
Yes, I feel that this will appeal if people like Agatha Christie and would like something that's much less known but is sort of set in the same middle-class, mid-century British world. It's a book of short stories called Good Evening, Mrs. Craven, The Wartime Stories of Molly Panther Downs. Now, Molly Panther Downs became famous in the war because she wrote the weekly letter from Britain that was published in The New Yorker.
Okay.
So she was a recorder of social life in the war, and people might not be aware that she also wrote these really, really fabulous short stories. I love them so much. They're like, I can't read more than one of them at once, because they're such a pleasure that when you finish one, you just want to think about it for a while. Good evening, Mrs. Craven. It's a collection by the absolutely fabulous Persephone Books. You know, these people who bring back old books and put them into these lovely editions with sort of wallpaper inside the end covers. So that's the print that they chose for this particular edition.
Yeah, I like
that. Molly Panterdowns.
Brilliant. Okay, we'll check that out. And do the paperback of Lucy Worsley's Agatha Christie, A Very Elusive Woman, is out now. So do go and grab that. I'd recommend the audiobook. I think you're a fabulous broadcaster, and it's lovely to hear you reading your own work. There's a lot of spunk in there from Lucy. In the old-fashioned sense. But it's really lovely to talk to you, and well done on this fabulous book, which I'm sure has done very well for you. So thank you for being on my podcast. And thank you also to Chris Evans for dealing with some technical difficulties this time. I think we've got through it. Hopefully we'll find out.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute joy.
Lovely. Thank you.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.